Well, we are in the midst of the Gospel of James. It's not the Gospel, although it really goes back and it calls us to be shaped by the Gospel. James was a firebrand of a preacher. He was a man who deeply, deeply resisted Christ all of his life up until the very end when Christ appeared to him in his resurrected form. And I think that James is so passionate about what he writes in this epistle, in this letter, because he resisted it so deeply for so long. When other people were coming to his brother, he was standing back and scoffing him. Until finally Jesus gave him the ultimate proof and appeared to him in a resurrected form. And he could no longer deny it. And so he says, I am all in. And he wanted people to be all in with him. We are in the midst of chapter 5. And we looked at last week about the problem of money with many of the people in the churches that he was writing to. And how he calls them out and he confronts the lies that they were believing. And he confronts them really the lies that many of us believe. When it comes to how we view money and wealth and possessions, it's a dangerous, dangerous topic. Over the years, a half dozen or so men have approached me, and they would say something like this, Martin, I'm getting a new job, or I got this big promotion. In all honesty, I'm going to be making more money than I've ever made in all of my life. And they would look at me and say, I'm afraid, they would not use these words, but this was the essence of what they were saying, is I'm afraid I know my heart. And I've seen what happens to those who are around me and around us. I've heard the stories of those who, when they encounter wealth, that suddenly their heart grows cold and they begin to worship what Jesus calls the God of Mammon. And something happens. They settle into a mediocrity. Oh, they may continue to go to church. And they may continue to even participate. But the fire that was in their lives dies way down and sometimes even goes out. They knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that they too were vulnerable to this. I don't trust myself. Would you hold me accountable? Would you talk with me about these things? If you see these patterns happening in my life, can we talk about it? Will you bring it up? They knew what I know to be very, very true in my own life and in the lives that I've worked with for some 28 years, 29 years, and that is pursuing or achieving wealth can be very, very toxic. It doesn't have to be, but it does something within us. Last week I asked the question, what does money and wealth mean or represent to me? What does it represent to you? It's a question that Kim and I, as we do premarital counseling, we try to engage in at some level. Usually they're not very wealthy when they come to me. You know, they're just starting out in life. Well, Martin, I don't make that much money. It's kind of way beyond me. But we at least entertain different things. But you don't have to have a lot of money for wealth and for money to mean all the wrong things. Wealth often means to us security. If I only have money, if I have enough money, if I have X number of dollars, I'm free from worry over my future. I no longer need to be afraid of having to deal with the fear of scarcity. How am I going to pay my bills? Sometimes money means, wealth means happiness. That means I finally have the ability to indulge my own personal desires, the desires of me and my wife and my family. I have the freedom to do that and to buy that new car, to purchase that new house. Finally, I'll be happy. There'll be a deep sense of satisfaction. Sometimes wealth and money means to us significance. That people, when they see what I drive or where I live, then at that point in time, they will respect my achievements. And they'll recognize the fact that I am somebody. I've earned my way to this level of economic status. We may kind of nod our head at those, but these, in all the different forms that they can take, can be very, very compelling. Of those who have entered into this accountability relationship with me over the last 28 years in one form or another, they've invited me into the process. As far as I know at this point in my life, there's only one person who's still doing well. One person who still has been able to maintain a proper perspective of money and wealth. Some people may ask, well, Martin, how do you know? Are you judging them? No, I'm not. How do I know? Because there's a subtle shift over time of priorities. It's not unusual, and it's not new to us. One of the characters in the New Testament that I have looked at for many years and has served as a warning for me, his name was Demas. He was a close friend and a partner in the gospel and is mentioned several times throughout the New Testament as being one of those who have laid out their life and given it all. As they went through ministry with Paul, he would partner with Paul in many different ways. But something happened. Something happened towards the latter half of his life, really the stage that I'm in. After 20 years or so, he finally walked away from it all. And in Paul's last letter that he ever wrote before he died, in 2 Timothy 4, he writes these sad, mournful words. Demas, because he loved this world, or because he, having loved this world, he has deserted me and gone on to Thessalonica. The idea there is that he cultivated this love on the backstage of his life over a period of time. And over time, he moved from this side of the continuum of being a fellow worker, a man who laid it all on the line, a man who left it all and would walk with Paul and journey with Paul through his travels, to one who, because of what was going on in the back of his mind, in the backstage, behind the curtain, nobody knew. He moved to this side when he said, you know, Paul, I'm checking out. Thessalonica, it's calling my name. Why? Why would he do it? Because he loved the things, the call of the world upon his life. And he began to believe the lies that we talked about last week, but only in the first century version of it. And it's sad, and I have often told the Lord, I don't want that to be my life. I don't want that to be my life. See, we are easily addicted. We easily hunger to something that's called self-gratification. We hunger for it. We're addicted to it if we're not careful. Addiction is nothing more than desires gone mad. But we can become easily focused on self-gratification, and we have a culture, and even a Christian culture, that says that's okay. Spurning the wisdom of Solomon in Ecclesiastes 5 that says, those who pursue wealth will never, ever, ever have enough. Those who love it. We are incredibly vulnerable. It's not that wealth is wrong or bad in and of itself. It's what it calls to within us. And this is the very situation that James is confronting, this self-gratification in chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. But I've been wrestling with the question. Last night we looked at what James said. I left you with this question. How should the gospel change our understanding of wealth and possessions? Why does that matter? Because we are people who are being formed by the gospel. and the gospel in that formation process for the glory of God, for the sake of myself and for the sake of others. Part of that must touch, must transform that part of me and how I view and understand wealth and possessions. The gospel must change our thinking and our choices. It's the premise of all that I want to say today. And if it doesn't, something is desperately wrong. And I'm not going to give you a checklist of being able to discern whether it is or isn't, but I want to give you an understanding so that you can navigate, so that I can navigate my own answers to that question. How has it changed me? Specifically in the area of wealth and possessions. Because there's no checklist. You can't look at the car or the truck that I drive and determine whether or not it has or has not. But what you can do is allow these thoughts to form us from the inside out. And then we can make our own choices, our own decisions. And we can invite others into a discussion, those with whom we walk and do life with. But this, know this, Jesus does not give us an option as to whether or not it should change us. It must change us. There are four words I want you to remember this morning. Identity is the first one. Identity, how we use and how we view wealth and possessions must be formed by our identity. We make this a big emphasis around here, but because everything must come from the person that God has declared us to be and the person He is making us into. I want us to look briefly at Deuteronomy chapter 8, one of my favorite books of the Bible, which is one of my favorite chapters in my favorite book of the Bible. Israel is preparing to go into the promised land, this place of great wealth, this place of great prosperity. And Moses stops them and he said, gives them some instructions throughout this whole book. And in chapter 8, he deals with the issue of wealth specifically. Remember how the Lord, your God, led you all the way into the wilderness these 40 years, he says in chapter 8, verse 2. Remember how the Lord did it. How did He do it? Not just that He did it, but what did He do as He was doing it? Remember how the Lord your God led you all the way into the wilderness for these 40 years. He's saying the Lord led you out of Egypt, this place of your old identity. That's why they were never to ever go back there. It's their old identity that's for us. It would be the kingdom of darkness, the kingdom of this world. That's for us is what Exodus was for them. They were never to ever go back there. It represented their old ways of relating, their old identity, their old ways of thinking. How He led you into the wilderness, this place of purging, this place of formation. These 40 years, why? To humble and to test you. Know this, that the Lord chose to test them. And the Lord will choose to test us at different points of our lives. To humble and to test you. Why? In order to know or to reveal, to put on display is the idea of the Hebrew there. What was in your heart, whether or not you would keep His commands. Now, who is He going to reveal that to? He was going to reveal it to Himself, but He already knew. But He wanted to reveal to the people who were being formed into the image of the people of God. He wanted to reveal to them that which they needed to see about their own hearts. So that they could be challenged and be reformed into His image. In order to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep His commands. Now, what did the Lord want to reveal? What did He want to expose in these 40 years of wanderings? He wanted them to wrestle with the question, will you live into the identity which claimed you at Sinai, and which you in turn claimed for yourself. And that is this: that God would be your God, and that you would be His people. That's covenant language. It's entering into the relationship. It's like a marriage ceremony. Are you going to allow that identity to reform your heart, your ways, your thinking, all aspects of your life? That's what He wanted to expose. That which was birthed at Sinai, at the giving of the Ten Commandments, and all that happened around there in Exodus 19, are you going to allow that to shape you? For us, that moment of decision, that moment of what I call conversion. When we bowed our knees and our hearts before the Lord and we said, Father, in your own words, you will be my God and I will be your son or your daughter. I give you my life. I surrender myself to your lordship. Are we willing to allow that moment in time, which was referenced and validated in the baptism that you had? Are you willing, am I willing to allow that to reshape and form the rest of my life, my heart, my ways, my thinking, my choices, even down to how I understand and view wealth and money? There were 40 years of tests that Israel had to take and lessons that they had to learn if they were going to be formed in this new identity. Now, how did the Lord test them so that they might learn these essential life lessons and be formed as His people? Read a book? I've got this curriculum I want you to go through? No, that's not what He did. In verse 3, He says this: He humbled you. Well, how did He humble you? By causing you to hunger. By causing you to hunger. And then feeding you with manna. Manna burgers, as Keith Green used to say. Manna waffles. Manna bread, which neither you nor your ancestors had ever known. He tested them through hunger, through a deep, gnawing hunger that oftentimes made them angry. To the point of where they would say, He just brought us out here to die. Let's go back to Egypt. At least there we had food. He tested them through hunger. He tested them through abundance. By giving them more than what they actually needed for that day, so that then they would be tempted to hoard it for themselves for tomorrow or the day next after or the day after. What are you going to do in the midst of your hunger or in the midst of your abundance? What did He want them to learn through this process of testing? What were the lessons to teach you or to cause you to learn that man or woman or as my people, Israel, as my people, church, does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord God. As His children being formed into His image, He's trying to teach them crucial lessons, and it's these. There is more to life than amassing stuff. For my people, and I'm assuming that's all of us here this morning, there is a lot more to life than amassing stuff like food and clothing and houses and land. This is not the stuff of life. This is not the stuff that will give you security, happiness and significance. That's not what it can do. Oh, it may feel like it in the moment, but then you're going to have to say, I'm going to have to go get more. That is not the stuff of life. That is not the means to the kind of life that God is calling His people into. That's not the kind of life that God is calling this church into, is amassing stuff. That's not what it is. That's not life. Well, life is connecting with God as their Father and as their King in a daily, dependent, life-giving relationship that transcends stuff. In other words, it doesn't matter if you have much or you have little. You can have, we can experience a sense of transcendent, life-giving relationship with our Father that's totally disassociated with, has nothing to do with stuff. That's the essence, that Word of God that we live on, that intimacy with our Father. And this confronts the lies that we looked at last week. They are going into a land of great plenty, a lot of wealth for them. And God is saying, I want to give you the blessings of this land, but don't you think for a moment that that is the stuff of life. If you do, he goes on to tell them, it'll all be taken away. It'll all be taken away. This is challenging to me. But God was forming their identity as his people. And as a gospel-formed people, he is just as committed to forming this identity by testing our hearts with both hunger, scarcity perhaps, and abundance. With the question, what are we going to do with it? Are we going to view this as the stuff of life? Or are we going to view connecting with our Father as the essence of what life is about? What is going to form us? That attitude, or the attitude which appeals so strongly to our natural inclinations? Our Father will test us. He will test us. He's committed to teaching us, causing us to learn these lessons. Some buy in, and they are formed by these lessons from the inside out, but many don't. Many, like Demas, who walk away. Our hearts must be formed by our identity. Our beliefs, how we view money and wealth and possessions, must be formed by our identity. So our first word that I want us to remember is what? Identity. Say it again. Identity. The second word is humility. Let's say that together. Humility. The first word is what? Identity. The second word is what? Identity. Humility. Good. Humility is a profound, profound piece of this curriculum that God is using to form us. We have a great picture of what this looks like in Proverbs 30, where the writer of this proverb says this, God, this is a prayer to him. God, give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Why? Why does he not want to have stuff stored up in his pantry for tomorrow? He says this, otherwise I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my Father. Regardless of how much or how little we have, we choose to live with a dependent humility that accepts, that rests in, that even rejoices that God is the provider of all that I have and not me. that God is the provider of all that I need and not me. And this really confronts sort of what I call, or what has become around here in some circles, what we call orphanism. And that's the belief where that's the belief that we are really, our identity is not that of a son or a daughter. Our belief really is that of, I'm an orphan. Or we may proclaim the words of a Christian identity, much like those in James, to whom James writes. But really how we view life is really shaped more by orphanism. And that is, whereas an orphan, I'm going to grab whatever I can for today. And if I can get enough for tomorrow too, I'm going to hoard that as well. And it's all about me. Because I don't trust anybody in my life. The only one I trust to take care of me is me. Humility. It rejoices that God is the provider of all that I have and not me. And that God is the provider of all that I need and not me. Regardless of what I have or don't have. So identity, humility, generosity. It's the third word I want us to remember. What was the first one? Identity. Second one? Identity. Third one? Generosity. Some of you are thinking, yes, he only has one more to go. Generosity rejoices that we are dispensers of God's gifts, not the owners of those gifts. That we are the dispenser, that I'm a conduit of being able to give to others, not that I'm going to own everything that I've got. You know, God gives us feed to consume, and he gives us seed that we are to plant into the lives of others. Sometimes my problem, sometimes our problem, is that we consume not just the feed, but we consume the seed as well. And God says, that's not generosity, that's orphan thinking. 1 Timothy 6:17, very familiar passage we'll work through real quickly. Paul tells Timothy, a young and timid pastor at Ephesus, command those who are rich in this present world. Let's pause there and just understand this. He was speaking great courage into Timothy's life because nothing was going to be more difficult for Timothy than to stand up and proclaim the words that he's going to have to be proclaiming. Calling out, much like James did in James 5, Timothy was now going to have to call out those who had very similar issues in Ephesus. And it was going to take a lot of courage. See, Ephesus was a very wealthy, wealthy city. It was called the first and greatest metropolis of Asia. It was also called the light of Asia. What he's saying there is this. There was a lot of wealth there. There was a lot of money. And as Timothy stood up and spoke how the gospel was to change their understanding of wealth and possessions in this very wealthy city, there was going to be some people who would say to him, get off our backs, preacher. You have no business speaking into my life. My money, my business. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope, their sense of joy, their sense of contentment, their sense of significance, their security. Not to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, unstable. But to put their hope in God, their Father, who richly provides for us everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich, or to be generous in good deeds. And to be generous and willing to share. Paul uses a very rare word. It's only used one other time in the book of Acts. And he gives the motivational force, the why this is important for them to grab this message. The why this is important for us to grab this message. And it is this. Our Father has been generous toward us in our need. And in that generosity, specifically in the gospel, he imprints within us. He marks our souls with his character. And his character is this: generosity. His imprint becomes the motivational force for our generosity towards others. It changes me from the inside out. That is, unless I sabotage it. So I don't ever want to underestimate the difficulty of what I'm talking about, because there are enemies to this. There are difficulties associated with this. Especially when you realize that what he's talking about is not simply the sharing of finances or the sharing of goods and services. He's talking about the sharing of life. Where those who are from different economic strata, they enter into the space of the others who are around them, even those who are of the lower economics, those who are poor. He says, don't be afraid to enter into their life. Not just giving of what they need, but the entering into their lives. But our generosity, this imprint which our Father imprinted upon us through the coming of the gospel, through our surrender to Him, our generosity is easily challenged and sabotaged. It challenges me personally. It challenges me personally. There's points where I wake up at 4:30 in the morning and I'm getting into the habit of just beginning my morning just with, Lord, this is what I'm feeling and this is what I'm thinking. I'm not asking you for anything. I'm not praying for anyone. This is just where I am, Father. My red dot. You know, when you go into the mall, you see those maps, you find the red dot and they say, you are here. This is where I am. There are points where I would just say, Lord, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I don't know what's going to happen in 10, 15 years with my retirement. You know, what happens when I can't preach anymore? They don't want me to. You know, what are you going to do, Father? And there are points where that can create anxiety within me. But God says, Martin, tell me about it. Now, Martin, remember, who are you talking to? Who do you think you're talking to, Martin? Tell me. You've told me where you are. Now, who do you think you're talking to? Well, Father, you're the provider in this case. You're the provider of all that I need and all that I have. Father, that gives me great assurance. I sure hope you are. You've never let me down. I've got more than enough food. I've got more than enough clothing. I've got more than enough house. I've got more than enough vehicles. But Father, just keep it up, would you? Martin, don't worry about it. I've got this. It's a challenge to me personally. I know it's a challenge to us personally, but it's also a challenge to us as a church. It's very important for us as a church to periodically do or sponsor what we call around here a giveaway Sunday. And a giveaway Sunday, for those of you who are newer, is a time when we will just declare this Sunday's offering is going to go to these ministries. It has nothing to do with the church, per se. It could be missions, outreach, different things like that, helping the needy. Now, it's really a lot of fun to do that when our profit and loss statement says, is in the positive, right? That's a time of rejoicing. Yes, get to give this away. Why? Because I don't need it. We don't need it as a church. We've got plenty. It's another story when the profit and loss statement is in the negative, where what we have spent is greater than what we have brought in, what has been given. At that point, then I just kind of cringe and I just kind of say, Lord, is this really a good idea? I'm not sure this is a great idea, Father. But it's more important to do it when there is a lack than it is when there is abundance. That is what I've discovered. Why? Who is the provider of what we need? Let's all say it together. 1, 2, 3. God. Who is the provider of what we have? God. that gives us courage, that gives us resolution, that says, no, we're going to do this. Why? Because our Father has been generous to us in our gospel, through the gospel. The Father has been generous to us. We don't even have a roof that leaks anymore. How cool is that? We spent years trying to fix leaks on this stinking roof. And finally, we got the roof replaced for free. Our Father has taken care of it. But it is a challenge, is it not? It is a challenge. Paul goes on in this way of generosity, this gospel-formed way, forming our understanding of finances and wealth. In this way, they, who? The rich folks, the poor folks, because they're observing all that's happening, will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation, one that is unshakable for the coming age, so that they may take hold of life that is truly life. Bingo. Exactly what God was telling Israel in Deuteronomy 8. We may live by the word of God, every word spoken by God Himself. That was the pattern, the motivation of Jesus when He was tested, and is the motivation for us when we are tested. He's saying, right now we can thrive, and it has nothing to do with what we have or don't have. This is a life that is formed by godly, by gospel wisdom. And just understand this. Our nature, our culture, our enemy, Satan himself, will always try to constrict our lives. He will always try to squeeze us to become the smallest entity that we can. But God's goal is to expand our lives so we can be all that the gospel is forming us into. And in the midst of that tension between constriction and expansion, we all have a choice. What will form that choice? Identity, humility, and generosity. Let's say it again. Identity, humility, generosity. But Martin, what happens? Because there are still things that I want, and I might have to give up stuff that I don't want. There's your fourth word, contentment. Humility or contentment rejoices that God has given me all that I need for today. What about tomorrow? No, for today. That's why Paul was able to say, you know what? I've learned to be content in all circumstances. God, the one who's the provider of all that I have, the one who's the provider of all that I need, has given me exactly what I need for today. Am I okay with that? How about this next one? I must be willing to say enough. That's what contentment says. I must be willing to say enough, even when it feels like it isn't. Even when it feels like it's not. Why? Because the Father has provided all that I have, and the Father will provide all that I need. Even though at times it may feel like it's not enough. But that's what contentment says. And just understand, our Father at different points in our lives will test us. He will test us with scarcity, and He will test us with abundance. All so that we may bow our knee before Him and say, you are my Father. You are my Father. Well, Martin, what happens if I need to sell my house? If I need to sell this or do that? Well, then you may need to. Downsizing is not a bad idea. what I have today, I may not have tomorrow. Is that okay? What I have today, I may not have tomorrow. Am I okay with that? Am I willing to downsize if I need to? In the Great Recession, once it settled into this area, I had spoken to us and I had spoken to the elders and others about the idea of, you know what, we just really need to be sure that we position ourselves so we can help out those who are in need. And we all bought into that. Everyone I talked with says, yes, that's a good idea. I said, now to do that, it may mean that we call our people, or might it be a good idea for us to call our people or invite our people, myself included, to sell something that is of importance to me. Can't sell my kids, but sell something that is of importance to me. And then be able to provide that as sort of seed money for those who are in need. And someone asked me the question. I had a 2004 Honda Shadow that had been given to me the year prior. It was just a beautiful bike. Had Cobra pipes on it. It was loud. Started it up for my granddaughter, scared her to death. And at that point, I said, yes, I would even be willing to sell that, I think. Constriction, right? Versus expansion. In the midst of that, there is always a choice. And I told the Lord, if that's what you want me to sell, then I will. Well, that idea never went someplace, anywhere. But what it did do was this. Is it made me wrestle with the idea. It made me wrestle with the idea. Am I willing to be constricted? Or am I willing to be expanded? In that is this choice. It's tough. Contentment. Contentment. This issue will test the most mature disciple. The most mature disciple. I've watched too many people go in the wrong direction. I've watched some people go in the right direction, beautiful direction of just generosity, because they had been formed, they were being formed by their identity, they were being formed by humility, they were being formed by generosity. And they would be formed by contentment. These are not things that anyone can declare for someone else, what it looks like. But these are ideas, principles that the gospel uses to shape how we view money and possessions. And as such, I do believe with all my heart it is important that the Word of God, these ideas, dwell not just within me in Colossians chapter 3, but among us as a body, that we talk about it, that we start by asking one another the question. It might be my spouse, it might be with my kids, it might be with someone in your small group. How have you seen these things form your life over your life? Where was there resistance? Was there anything that really sabotaged it along the way? And is there any resistance today? Any resistance today? And how does the gospel want to deal with that resistance? These are questions that are important for us to wrestle with, folks. I was going to have a Q&A time, but I'm already 10 minutes over. If you have questions about this, send them to me. I would love to be able to engage you with these. However, and through whatever means necessary, social media or whatever, but I want us to wrestle with this as a body. We were talking about this in my small group on Monday night, and someone says, you didn't even bring up tithing. That's not what this is about. This is about being formed by the gospel, how I deal with money, wealth, and possessions, of which tithing is a part of that. But that's not what this is about today. It's about being formed into the image of Christ for the glory of God, for the sake of myself, and for the sake of others. Father, you invite us to take a hold of life, which is truly life. Lord, I don't know of anyone who would admit at the end of his life or her life in those last breaths would say, I wish I would have saved more. I wish I would have bought more. For Father, at that point in time, at that point of transition, we are struck with the choice, with the realization that everything that we have here, we will one day leave behind. And we will only take with us that which we have prepared for through our choices and our actions. Father, help us to be able to be wise and discerning people who choose life that is truly, truly life. In Jesus' name.